Finding a hoodie that lasts through the season can be tough. The American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it year after year. Every American Giant piece is made in America and designed to last. No exceptions. The result is durable clothing that become part of your life. Snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life. The American Giant Classic Full Zip. Save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today I'm bringing you a story that has been highly requested. It is an ongoing case, and so the trial for this case is actually set to begin this summer, and we'll get to all of that. But this is a case that really hits close to home as a true crime content creator, and you will soon learn why. If you haven't already heard about this case, let me tell you about the story of Sarah Grace Patrick. But before I do, I want to remind you that CrimeCon is going to be happening in May of this year in Vegas. If you are interested in going, go to crimecon.com and make sure you use the code MAMAMYSTERY when you check out to get a discount on your overall total and to secure your spot at a live high-energy weekend where podcasters, journalists, investigators, survivors, and fans of true crime all come together to deep dive cases, hear firsthand stories, and obsess over crime in a way only our community really gets. So go to crimecon.com. It's the last weekend in May, and I hope to see you there. Without further ado, let's get into today's story. What you can't explain has a way of returning, like a haunting refrain that just plays over and over until you finally face it. When the call came in to Carroll County Dispatch on February 20th of last year, nothing about it made sense. A frantic teenager told operators that her little sister had stumbled into their parents' bedroom and found both of them dead. It was the unthinkable, unexplainable, and within hours, the case was on every news channel in Georgia. Over the next year, the murder of 41-year-old Kristen Brock and her 45-year-old husband, James, or Jamie Brock, would turn into one of the most bizarre true crime stories in recent memory. Rumors swirled on social media, family members gave sometimes contradictory interviews, and the TikTok community watched a grieving teenager cry on camera while quietly wondering why her story didn't quite add up. Before long, that teen, Sarah Grace Patrick, would find herself at the center of the investigation, arrested for the very murders that she seemed desperate to solve. Now, this case is still unfolding. Much of what has been reported comes from either court documents, press conferences, and interviews with family members and investigators. As of this writing, which is January 12th of 2026, Sarah Grace remains behind bars awaiting her trial. But let's go back to what exactly landed her in this position in the first place. On the morning of February 20th, 2025, Carroll County Sheriff's deputies received a 911 call from a distraught 16-year-old Sarah Grace Patrick. Now, according to Sarah, her 6-year-old half-sister, Jay, who I think might have been 5 at the time, had gone into their parents' bedroom around 7 a.m. and discovered something unimaginable. Kristen and James Brock were lying in bed covered in blood. Sarah later told her family that Jay had touched their mother's hand and realized it was ice cold. Deputies arrived at the home on Tyus Carrollton Road, a rural area west of Atlanta, and found the couple shot to death in their bed. Initial press reports described a gruesome scene. Both victims had been shot multiple times, and there was no sign of forced entry. Nothing in the house was missing or ransacked. Investigators found no murder weapon. An exterior door was found slightly ajar, but it wasn't clear whether it had been left open or if someone had slipped in unnoticed. Given the firearm missing and the lack of any kind of self-inflicted wounds, the sheriff's office quickly ruled out a murder-suicide. Now let's go back to who exactly were Kristen and James Brock. Kristen Nolan Brock had built her life in Carroll County. She was the daughter of Dennis Nolan, a man that she remained close to throughout her life. Kristen was described by friends and church members as a beautiful, kind soul who worked hard to provide for her children. Before meeting James, she had 2 children, Sarah Grace and her younger brother from a previous relationship. In 2014 or 2015, she met James Brock and the couple began dating. They were together for nearly a decade before marrying on December 12th of 2023. Together, they raised a blended family of 7 children, including James's own children from previous relationships. Now, James, or Jamie Brock, was known around town for his booming laugh and his devotion to his family. He was active in Catalyst Church, where he served in various capacities alongside Kristen. Friends said that after a turbulent period earlier in life, including a previous marriage, issues with substance use, and run-ins with the law, James had turned over a new leaf. He was dealing with significant health problems. His heart was so weak that he relied on a left ventricular assist device, otherwise known as an LVAD, which is a mechanical pump that helps to circulate blood. Family social media posts revealed that James had been hospitalized in July of 2021 and that he had spent years waiting for a heart transplant. The LVAD made a constant humming noise and would sound an alarm if the flow of blood stopped or if the battery died, which is a detail that will become important later. But ultimately, Kristen and James were described as being deeply in love. They posted frequent photos of their blended family on Facebook and spoke publicly about their faith. According to relatives, they volunteered at church events and encouraged others in recovery. No one in their circle could imagine that someone wanted them dead. Immediately, investigators cordoned off the home and began collecting evidence. They canvassed the neighborhood and interviewed everyone who might have had contact with the Brocks in the days leading up to the shootings. Early press releases from the sheriff's office stressed that there were no signs of forced entry, that nothing was stolen, and that the case was being treated as a double homicide. The absence of a gun suggested that whoever killed the Brocks had taken the murder weapon with them. Now, initially, there was little information about potential suspects. Media reports noted that Sarah Grace Patrick, who was then a junior in high school, had been inside the house when the shootings occurred. In her 911 call, she said that she had been asleep when the shots were fired and that she only woke up when her little sister came to get her. Sarah later told relatives and investigators that she didn't hear gunshots at all, but instead she claimed she heard the alarm on James's LVAD going off about 15 to 20 minutes before she went to bed the night before. Now, this assertion really raised eyebrows. The LVAD's alarm is designed to alert the wearer if the pump stops functioning, but is far quieter than a gunshot. So if she could hear the LVAD chirp, then why didn't she hear multiple gunshots in a fairly small house? Family members even confirmed and later emphasized that the bedrooms in the Brock home were only about 8 feet apart and that it would be nearly impossible to sleep through the sound of repeated gunshots. Now, from the moment the murders were announced, people began speculating about what could have happened. Because there were no obvious enemies or financial motives, many locals feared that the killer might be a stranger on the loose. On Facebook, friends urged one another to lock their doors and check their home security cameras. Others floated wild theories from gang hits to jealous exes, but none of it made sense. And then something kind of unusual happened. Sarah Grace Patrick took to social media almost immediately after her mother and stepfather's deaths. Using her father's Facebook account, because investigators had seized her phone, she posted long explanations of what she said happened and pleaded with anyone who might know anything to come forward. In one post, she wrote that people were spreading lies about forced entry and insisted that she was the one who had called 911, not her little sister. Sarah described herself as devastated, noting that she had not only lost her mother and stepfather, but also her home and her clothes and her sense of safety. Soon, she moved to TikTok, where she created a new account dedicated entirely to memorializing Kristen and James. Now, her videos ranged from clips of family gatherings to selfies of herself crying while overlapping these like popular audio tracks. And one trending sound used the line, "They don't know it, but a year from now, our family will be torn apart." And Sarah paired it with photos of herself and her parents. In another video, she posted these glamorous photos of herself. They kind of, for lack of a better word, I'm going to call them like thirst traps because that's really what they look like. It's like her posing in the mirror with like, you know, these, hard angles to really give yourself like the best figure, I guess, in the mirror. And she's wearing these like provocative clothes, kind of, and she's got her hair and makeup done. Like, she looks like she's about to go out on the town. And then as you scroll, like, past that one picture, it's like a carousel of these photos. She's got pictures of herself sobbing with mascara tears running down her face and captions like, it hasn't hit yet that they're actually gone. And the world ended when it happened to me. And I just want my mama. Like, all of these pictures with these captions attached to them. But I thought it was odd that the first photo in the carousel is of her dressed up in the mirror. Maybe it's to get more attention so that people will look at the rest of the carousel. I don't really know, but many people found it kind of odd that that's what she was choosing to post. So the post drew sympathy, but also suspicion. Some viewers noted that the crying seemed kind of performative, and others wondered why she was even posting at all. But one particular slideshow started with Sarah dressed up and then ended with the word hallelujah, which felt out of step for someone who had just lost her parents in such a horrific way. In the caption, she told followers that she'd make a video addressing rumors and things that have been mixed up, but she actually asked them if she wanted it. She's like, comment if you want more info on my story. Now, the attention on TikTok quickly ballooned. Sarah's follower count grew, and people across the country were commenting on the case. As her TikTok presence grew, she began contacting true crime content creators, asking them to cover her parents' case. One creator, who goes by Allegedly Reportedly, shared screenshots of messages that she had received from an account named Sarah Grace. The messages said, "Search up Brock case." And when the creator asked which Brock, the reply was, "Kristen and James Brock. They're my parents." And out of nowhere, a random Thursday night in February, someone came in my house with me and my 5-year-old sister and shot my parents, brutally leaving them for me and my little sister to wake up to. And then she continues saying, "I think it would be a really big hit because the only person who posted about it made it as their first image you see when you Google their names. Plus, I can give you intel, just I can't give you anything that could break the case. That's what the cops told me." Now, that is word for word what she said to this creator. I can't imagine losing my parents to murder and being like, "You should cover this case. I think it'd be a really big hit." Like, what? That's just... it's disconnecting in my brain. And it struck many as bizarre. When Allegedly Reportedly later found out about Sarah's arrest, she admitted that Sarah's approach had raised some red flags, but that at the time she thought it was just an eccentric, grieving teenager. And she's actually done interviews with News Nation where she basically says, you know, she thought it was weird at first, but thought maybe this is just kind of how teenagers talk these days. So I don't want to, you know, cause any heat for Allegedly Reportedly. I think, you know, you always try to find the best in people. And I don't think it ever occurred to her within those first few messages that Sarah Grace would be responsible for murdering her own parents and then reaching out to her, asking her to tell the story, right? So about 3 weeks after the murders, a memorial service was held at Catalyst Church. Sarah gave a eulogy that was both heartfelt and kind of unsettling, depending on how you viewed the eulogy. She first began by thanking everyone for coming and explained that she stuttered and might stumble over her words. And she then read a letter that her mother had written to James in 2018 and quoted scripture about trusting God. She spoke about her mother's gratitude, James' life lessons, and how she would always be her mother's sunshine and her mother would always be her star. She implored the audience not to take loved ones for granted because you never know when it's somebody's time to go. Throughout the speech, she used a faltering, sobbing voice, and yet noticeably no tears ever rolled down her cheeks. And when she finished, she softly said, "I'm sorry." I'm going to play a clip of it. It is kind of hard to understand, but just to give you an idea of what this eulogy was like.
"For those of you who do not know me, my name is Sarah, and I am Kristen Brock's daughter and James Brock's stepdaughter. This isn't easy, and I don't know how Ben and Angie do this all the time, but I'm really happy I get to do this, but just bear with me because I stutter a lot. I just wanted to say goodbye to my mom and James since we never got the chance to. I was so used to you guys always being here to the point that I never once thought to imagine y'all not being here. I didn't have a single clue how much I needed y'all until now. For James, thank you for all the life lessons you taught me and for being the best bonus dad ever. Your heart will finally be healed in heaven and neither of y'all will be in any pain anymore. Although that gives me so much comfort, your fight was not supposed to end there. And for my mother, everything we went through does not define what kind of person or what kind of mother you were. You were a beautiful, kind soul with so much gratitude and so gosh dang strong. And you taught me so many life lessons, and something you just recently taught me was through a letter you sent to James in 2018. When I first read it, I smiled and I cried, and I got chill bones. But every single time I read it, it puts me to a lot of peace.
To some who were in attendance, the speech came across as a moving tribute, but to others, it felt like a performance. Specifically, Kristen Dauda, who is James's niece, later said that she was sitting in the front row and watched Sarah deliver the speech without shedding a single tear. Kristen pointed out that the other family members could barely get through their remarks because they were crying so hard, and yet Sarah, who had supposedly just lost her mother, wasn't shedding a single tear, and the word sorry at the end of the eulogy was especially striking. Some took it as an apology for her delivery, while others wondered if it was an inadvertent confession. Investigators also noted the sorry, and while they haven't disclosed why it mattered to them, it certainly contributed to their developing story. As the investigation continued, various members of the family spoke to the media, often contradicting each other. Dennis Nolan, who is Kristen's father, urged the community to come forward with any information. He told reporters that Jay had found her parents and woken up Sarah, who then called 911. While Dennis admitted that the details were unsettling, he himself had a hard time believing that Sarah hadn't heard the gunshots, but he insisted he saw no concrete evidence that Sarah was involved in his daughter's murder. He described her as being a good kid, friendly, and never one to ask for much. He also acknowledged that investigators told him there was mountains of evidence, but he said the detectives wouldn't share it because it was an open case. Sarah's biological father, who is Don Patrick, was more outspoken. After divorcing Kristen in 2019, Don had fought for and eventually obtained full custody of Sarah and her brother, but he allowed them to live with Kristen and James in 2023 because they provided a stable home. Don said that when he received a call from investigators on February 20th, he went to the sheriff's office where Sarah was being interviewed as a witness. He claimed the detectives interrogated her and showed her photos of her parents' bodies without his permission. Don stressed that he and Sarah had a transparent relationship and that she could always tell him the truth. He insisted she didn't know anything and that she cooperated fully. He also asserted that he didn't turn her in. She voluntarily surrendered once warrants were issued. And then in a later interview, Don claimed that there was evidence of a break-in, pointing to what he said were crowbar marks on a back door and suggesting that the real killer might have been connected to a drug deal gone wrong. He even noted that a family friend had once pulled a gun on James and Kristen, implying that the couple did have enemies. However, law enforcement officials dismissed the idea of forced entry, and Don's claims about a drug dispute have never been corroborated by evidence. Don also told reporters that Sarah had been on TikTok looking for answers because the family wasn't getting updates from the sheriff's office. When asked why Sarah would message an influencer about her parents' murders, he suggested that she simply wanted help. Don maintained that Sarah was not violent, had never been in a fight, and had only fired a gun once or twice in her life. He expressed frustration that the police seized Sarah's phone and that she had to use his and his Facebook account to communicate with the public. Not everyone in the family believed in Sarah's innocence. Kristen Dauda, who I mentioned earlier, disclosed that she and other relatives had harbored suspicions soon after the murders. She recalled James telling her family months earlier, quote, "You don't know the real Sarah. She's not who she pretends to be," end quote. Now, Kristen Dauda did not elaborate on what James meant by that, but she later said that after hearing the details of the murders and watching Sarah's behavior at the funeral, she began to wonder if James's warning had been prophetic. She also said that the younger sister, Jay, had told forensic interviewers that she heard gunshots and the LVAD alarm, contradicting Sarah's claim that she only heard the LVAD. Now, Kristen Dauda emphasized that the house was small and the bedrooms were close together, again, making it nearly impossible to sleep through the sound of multiple gunshots. As the weeks passed, rumors of Sarah's possible involvement only intensified, yet investigators did not rush to arrest her. Ashley Holsey, the spokesperson for the Carroll County Sheriff's Office, would later explain that the investigation required extensive forensic, digital, and geographic analysis. Detectives worked with the FBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, so the GBI, and private laboratories to process evidence. The sheriff's office poured thousands of man hours into reviewing phone records, social media posts, search histories, and surveillance footage. While the case attracted national attention, Holsey reminded reporters that unlike on television, real justice takes time.
Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode. So we all know what our chronological age is. It's just your birthday, right? But biological age is how old your body actually is on the inside. And that part matters way more than most of us realize. Your biological age is one of the strongest predictors of disease risk and overall longevity, basically how your body is aging over time. And that is where True Diagnostic comes in. They used advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million data points from a simple at-home test to tell you how fast you're aging and what's actually going on inside your body. And the best part is they don't just dump the data on you. They give you a clear, personalized 90-day plan so you know exactly what to do with the information that you get. There are a couple different testing options depending on what you want to focus on. So they have their True Age test, which looks at longevity and aging. It compares your biological age to your chronological age, shows your current pace of aging, and even breaks things down by organ system, like your heart, brain, lungs, immune system, and more. You get your top three aging actions to focus on, and get this, 86% of users who follow the plan actually reduce their biological age. They also have True Health, which focuses on how healthy you are right now. It checks over 105 vitamins, minerals, nutrients, and health markers, with a big focus on energy, metabolism, inflammation, and nutrient status. Again, you get your top three health actions to work on over the next 90 days. Or if you want the full picture, there's the combo kit, which honestly is the best value. It combines both True Age and True Health so you can see how fast you're aging and how healthy you are today. Plus, you get three aging actions and three health actions to focus on for each quarter. The process itself is super simple. You order online, the kit ships right to your door, you do a quick finger prick at home, and then drop it in the prepaid return package. Your results come digitally along with an easy-to-follow 90-day plan, and your only job is to follow the three recommendations for 90 days. Then you can retest and actually see your progress. So you can do a one-time kit if you want just a baseline or if you're curious, or you can do the subscription, which gives you four tests per year. That turns it into an accountability tool instead of a one-and-done type of thing. You're tracking your real changes over time. That's the kind of person that I am. I like to overanalyze and, like, you know, paralysis from analysis. That's very much me. So if you're like that, I can see why you would want to do the subscription as well. Now, this is the same type of testing used by top longevity clinics and health professionals. It is real science. It's not trends or guesswork. And it helps cut through the noise by showing you the three most important things your body actually needs right now. And right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using the code Mama at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDiagnostic.com, and use the code Mama, MAMA, for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. Let me know what you think when you try it.
Nearly 5 months after the murders, on July 8th of 2025, the sheriff's office held a press conference. Sheriff Terry Langley announced that an arrest had been made. Sarah Grace Patrick, who at that point was 17 years old, was charged with two counts of murder and two counts of aggravated assault. Investigators said the arrest came after collecting mountains of physical and digital evidence, including data from phones, computers, and social media accounts. She told reporters that the case had consumed thousands of man hours and that investigators had worked closely with federal and state partners. She cautioned that more arrests could follow if additional evidence pointed to any kind of accomplice. She said, quote, "We had to consider everyone a suspect at first, but the evidence kept leading us to Sarah," end quote. When asked about the motive, Holsey said that remained under investigation. So Sarah turned herself in at the Carroll County Jail, accompanied by her father. At her first court appearance, she wore a gray jumpsuit and appeared visibly shaken. Cameras captured her hugging her attorneys and then breaking down in actual tears this time. The image of the teenager sobbing behind a table of lawyers became kind of a fixture on local news. In a brief statement, Holsey said that Sarah would be tried as an adult. The charges at that point included 2 counts of murder and 2 counts of aggravated assault. Investigators have not publicly released the full case file, but they have hinted at the types of evidence that led to Sarah's arrest. Digital evidence appears to be central to the case. Sarah's phones and devices were seized early in the investigation, and investigators reportedly recovered data showing that she deleted text messages, searched for information on cleaning up crime scenes, and contacted others about the murders. They also analyzed location data from her devices and concluded that she was at the home at the time of the shootings. Surveillance video from neighbors reportedly showed no unknown vehicles entering or leaving the property around the time of the murders. Forensic testing on items collected at the crime scene, including clothing and bedding, provided additional clues, possibly gunshot residue. One of the most contentious details is whether investigators found GSR on Sarah or her belongings. Now, police have not confirmed this publicly, but rumors persist that GSR, or gunshot residue, was detected on a pair of Sarah's shorts. What investigators did say is that the murder weapon has not been recovered, suggesting it was removed from the home after the shootings. Given that Sarah was the only person known to have access to the house during the relevant time frame, they believe she must have disposed of the gun. Another key factor appears to be Sarah's social media activity. The sheriff's office acknowledged that the case was built partly on digital footprints, Sarah's TikTok posts, messages to those true crime content creators, and her search history were all examined. Investigators suggested that some of those messages seem to encourage others to focus on the case, maybe perhaps to create an alibi or control the narrative. When the ABC network later reported on the arrest, they quoted Holsey as saying investigators had collected mountains of evidence and had reason to believe Sarah had tried to cover up the crime. On August 19th, a bond hearing was held in Carroll County Superior Court. The hearing lasted more than 2 hours and drew a crowd that included family members from both sides, church friends, and just curious onlookers. The courtroom felt divided. On one side sat supporters of Sarah, including her pastor and friends wearing "I Stand With Sarah" t-shirts, whereas on the other side sat relatives of James Brock, some of whom said that they were afraid of Sarah. Prosecutors argued that Sarah should remain in jail. They said she posed a risk to the community, could influence witnesses, including her little sister, and might try to flee if she's released. They noted that she had lived with multiple families in the months following the murders, suggesting she might lack stability. Caitlin O'Keefe, a woman who took Sarah in for a period, testified that Sarah cried frequently and seemed traumatized. Prosecutors also pointed to Sarah's TikTok messages as evidence that she tried to manipulate the narrative. Sarah's defense team countered that she had no criminal history, she was deeply rooted in the community, and was presumed innocent until proven guilty. They argued that Sarah was a 17-year-old high school student who had never been violent and that she had fully cooperated with investigators. They emphasized that she had voluntarily turned herself in and that her father would ensure that she appeared in court if she were released. They even offered to have her wear an ankle monitor and remain on house arrest. The most emotional testimony came from family members. Relatives of James Brock pleaded with the judge not to let Sarah out of jail, saying that they feared for their safety. They recounted that James had confided to them that Sarah wasn't the person you think she is, and that they referenced a letter he wrote describing his worries. Sarah's supporters said that she was being unfairly vilified. Her grandfather, Dennis Nolan, who is Kristen's dad, told reporters that he didn't believe she committed the murders and implored the court to remember that she was innocent until proven guilty. Ultimately, Judge Dustin Hightower denied bond. He ruled that prosecutors had presented enough evidence to show that Sarah might be a danger to the community and that there was a risk she would attempt to influence witnesses or flee. However, he emphasized that Sarah was presumed innocent and that his decision was based on ensuring a fair trial, not on punishing her. Within hours of the bond denial, a grand jury indicted Sarah on 8 counts, 2 counts of malice murder, 2 counts of felony murder, 2 counts of aggravated assault, and 2 counts of possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony. The indictment alleges that she intentionally and unlawfully caused the deaths of Kristen and James Brock by shooting them with a firearm. A formal arraignment was set for September 22nd. Now, in December of 2025, the Carroll County Court set a trial date as January 5th of 2026. During a December 16th hearing, both the prosecution and defense told the judge they were ready to proceed, but noted that they were waiting on a report from a forensic neuropsychologist who had evaluated Sarah over the summer. The evaluation could be critical if Sarah's attorneys plan to raise questions about her mental health at the time of the murders. The defense said the report would be delivered around Christmas. Prosecutors asked for time to review it and possibly request their own expert. Judge Hightower praised both sides for adhering to an aggressive schedule and said he would only delay the trial if fairness required it. Then, just days before the trial was set to begin, the defense revealed that the final neuropsychology report still hadn't been delivered. The state wanted to conduct its own exam, and the defense insisted the report wasn't necessary to proceed. Judge Hightower acknowledged the tight timeline he had imposed and reluctantly granted a continuance. So on January 5th, he reset the trial for August 3rd, this summer, warning that no further delays would be permitted. He said, "I don't want this case to languish. I don't want her to sit where she doesn't need to sit if that's not where she's supposed to be." End quote. He also scheduled a bond reconsideration hearing for January 27th because Sarah had been in solitary confinement since July and her lawyers argued that extended isolation was harming her mental health. The court indicated that the results of the psychological exam would be heard at trial alongside other evidence. Prosecutors maintained that they had a strong case built on both physical and digital evidence and that they were ready to proceed whenever the trial date arrives. Now, one of the first questions raised by both investigators and family members was how Sarah could have slept through multiple gunshots. James and Kristen were each shot several times, including at least one shot to the head, according to the indictment and later reports. But Kristen Dowda, again, claimed that, you know, the bedrooms were close together and the walls were super thin. And she also noted that Jay, the 5-year-old daughter or little sister, heard both the LVAD alarm and the gunshots. But Sarah claimed that she only heard the LVAD. Even if the television in Sarah's room was on, many find it implausible that gunfire would not have awakened her, especially given the open floor plan of the home and the multiple gunshots. So Sarah told a family friend that she heard James's LVAD machine alarm go off about 10 to 20 minutes before she went to bed, and that she noted the sound because the house was quiet. She said she went to sleep around midnight and heard nothing else. However, the alarm on an LVAD typically sounds when the pump loses power or the heart stops pumping blood, situations that are medical emergencies. So Don Patrick acknowledged that when James's LVAD alarm went off at restaurants, it was noticeable but not very loud. Still, he said James always either reset the device or went to the hospital if he couldn't make it stop. So critics question why Sarah wouldn't have been alarmed when the device continued beeping after midnight and why she didn't at least check on James. If she did check and found him non-responsive, then why didn't she call 911 right away? If the alarm didn't sound again until the shootings, then it's unclear what she heard earlier that night. Then you have, was there forced entry? The issue of forced entry. Don Patrick asserted that police overlooked evidence of a break-in, pointing to marks on a door that he believes were made by a crowbar or a pry bar. He suggested that if Kristen and James slept with their doors unlocked, an intruder could have simply walked in. Investigators, however, have repeatedly said that there were no signs of forced entry. They noted that the house was in a rural area with few nearby neighbors and that surveillance footage from around the property showed no strangers entering. Now, Holsey, the sheriff's spokesperson, called Don's claims unsubstantiated. And then you have the question of could there have been accomplices? During the July 8th press conference, Holsey raised the possibility of additional arrests. At the August bond hearing, she reiterated that investigators were still following leads and interviewing potential witnesses. Now, some have speculated that Sarah may have had help removing the weapon or cleaning up the scene. Others have suggested that someone else could have been in the house. So far, no one else has been charged, and prosecutors have hinted that the digital evidence points to Sarah acting alone, but they have stopped short of ruling out accomplices altogether. But perhaps the biggest unanswered question is why? What could drive a teenager to kill her mother and stepfather, and then let her 5-year-old little sister go find the bodies? Prosecutors have not publicly discussed motive, and Georgia law does not require them to prove one. Still, observers have offered theories. Some point to possible family conflict, because in the months before the murders, Sarah reportedly expressed a desire to move in with her father, whom she described as more lenient. Others suggest attention-seeking may have played a role, citing Sarah's TikTok posts and her willingness to contact true crime influencers. There are also rumors that mental health issues were involved. And I also took it upon myself to just scan Kristen's Facebook page. And I've noticed that a lot of her posts from 2022, so this is a couple, 2 to 3 years ago, you know, prior to this homicide happening, it seemed that she was having issues with James, that they were having relationship problems, and that she was kind of voicing her frustrations or venting on social media. In one post, she wrote, and this is dated September 30th of 2022, it says, quote, "Yeah, this hurts me, but it's going to hurt her more, Jay." She uses the full name, but I've been saying Jay just to protect the child's privacy. She goes on to say, "Please pray for us and our safety. Please let me know if you see James Brock so you can warn me. He is trying to kill me, has been to get the house and child. Man, wasted tears, now huge fears." Then she also posted September 30th, 2022, saying, quote, "Hey, me and James are not together, not even friends. I don't really know him at all. I'm ashamed and hurt and embarrassed. Never again will you bring filth to my life. You play people like a fiddle, not just me anymore. Karma will be your king, King Brock, LMAO," end quote. Then it appears she might have made a new profile, but September 27th of 2022, she posted to this other profile a quote. It's like a picture with a quote on it that says, "We communicate, we fix, we stay. That's maturity." And then we know they got married in December of the following year. So who's to say what their life was like behind closed doors? Nobody really knows except the people who were in the house. And another possibility raised by Don Patrick is that Kristen and James were involved in a marijuana deal that went bad and that someone came to the house seeking revenge. Don said Sarah had told investigators about a person they suspected, but he claimed police cleared that lead. Investigators have not commented on any drug-related angle, and there is no evidence that substances were involved at the time of the murders. Now, one of the most baffling aspects of this case is Sarah's behavior online. Her TikTok videos show a teenager oscillating between grief and glamour. Critics see the post as performative. Supporters view them as a coping mechanism. The fact that she told a true crime creator that the case would be a really big hit and then offered intel suggests a level of media savvy that is just unsettling. It calls to mind earlier cases like that of Michelle Carter, where a young person's digital footprint became a crucial piece of evidence in a homicide trial. Now, in Carter's case, text messages encouraging her boyfriend to take his own life led to a conviction for involuntary manslaughter. Whereas in Sarah's case, prosecutors may argue that her social media activity reveals a desire to control the narrative or even to bask in notoriety. Now, Michelle Carter's case, if you're unaware, happened up in the Northeast. I don't know like the specific details right off the top of my head, but in Michelle Carter's case, her boyfriend had made comments about being suicidal or having suicidal ideations, and she essentially encouraged him through these text messages to finally take his own life, and then he finally did. And so she was held responsible for not only not getting him the help that he needed or alerting his family that he was having these thoughts, that she was actually culpable because she was pushing him to do it. And, you know, essentially like, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of mocking him for not going through with it. And multiple times she would say things like, I know you won't, and this is all going to be a waste of time anyway, or something to that effect. Maybe someday I'll do a deep dive on that story, but there is a documentary about it on HBO, and then there's also been a scripted series made about that case. But anyways, as of today, January 12, 2026, Sarah Grace Patrick is awaiting trial in the Carroll County Jail. She has been in custody since July 8th of 2025. She again faces 8 felony counts. The trial is set to begin on August 3rd of 2026. A bond reconsideration hearing is set for later this month, so I will keep an eye on that, and I'll probably update with the results of that trial in a weekly docket when that time comes. The psychological evaluation is still pending. Prosecutors will likely want their own expert to assess Sarah, and the results could influence the trial strategy, so we'll see what happens there. And again, no motive has been officially disclosed, and the murder weapon has not been recovered. Now, the victim's families remain divided. Some relatives of James Brock believe Sarah is dangerous and want her kept behind bars. Her father and grandfather insist that she is innocent and that the real killer is still out there. Church members who knew the Brocks are conflicted. Many find it hard to reconcile the warm girl that they knew with the cold crime that she is accused of. I mean, even in her eulogy, she says something about her mom. She's like, she was so gosh dang kind, or something to that effect. Like, she won't even bring herself to cuss. And granted, she's in a church, it's a eulogy. But it's just something that's hard to reconcile, the thought of this murderous teenage girl with this girl who's crying during the eulogy for her mom and stepdad. I don't know. It's just, it's very, very intriguing. The community is bracing for a long and painful trial. I will likely be following it and keep you updated on this case as it evolves. I want to know your thoughts on this case. If you're listening to this story on Spotify, you can leave a comment on this episode. And if you want to send me a message, you can at any time through my website, mamamystery.com. Now that's it for today. I'll see you Friday for the weekly docket, where I'll recap the top headlines in true crime for the week. If you have a story you want to share with me, go to mamamystery.com and send it my way. I hope you all have a great week. Stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery.